What the Lord wants to speak to us tonight about from his word is Luke chapter 14, verse 1 and then 7 to 14. One Sabbath, when Jesus went to eat in the house of a prominent Pharisee, he was being carefully watched. When he noticed how the guests picked the places of honor at the table, he told them this parable. When someone invites you to a wedding feast, do not take the place of honor, for a person more distinguished than you may have been invited. If so, the host who invited both of you will come and say to you, give this person your seat. Then, humiliated, you will have to take the least important place. But when you are invited, take the lowest place, so that when your host comes, he will say to you, friend, move up to a better place. Then you will be honored in the presence of all the other guests. For all those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted. Then Jesus said to his host, when you give a luncheon or dinner, do not invite your friends, your brothers or sisters, your relatives, or your rich neighbors. If you do, they may invite you back, and so you will be repaid. But when you give a banquet, invite the poor, the crippled, the lame, the blind, and you will be blessed. Although they cannot repay you, you will be repaid at the resurrection of the righteous. This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks, Tony. Lord be with you. You sound good tonight. Really encouraged by your story, so thank you for sharing all those who came up. Really appreciate that. So exciting to see God at work among us, and particularly amongst the youngest here. It's really a delight, and I think it warms everyone's hearts in the rooms to hear those stories, so keep sharing them with us. And if you haven't, if we haven't given space for you to hear those, to share those stories, then tug me in, or rugby tackle me or something in order to make sure that you get space to have your voice heard. So where are we going tonight? Well, we're thinking about what it is to enter a new term, a new space, and what it is that feeling like when you are entering a new classroom or entering a new university or entering your office back having gone away on holiday or coming into a new season of your life. And I don't know if any of that relates to any of you, but that's certainly what it feels like for me at the moment. And of course, there are many things to think about, but what Jesus does here is he helps us to think about the way we relate to other people when we're in those new situations. And I think this story that we're looking at tonight might have something to say to us that could really resonate with where we are, particularly when we're stepping into a new situation. I wonder whether you're ready for the new term, how you're feeling about it. I don't know. I love the season. I love the season shift. I love the weather shift. I love the dew on the grass, that kind of thing in the morning when you wake up early in the morning and suddenly it's a shift. You know, you can feel it in the air. But it also brings with it a nervous feeling, like Sunday evenings, like Sunday nights. You know, Sunday nights is both a good night, but it's a bad night as well, because Monday always follows Sunday, and Monday's not the best day, is it? Am I the only one that thinks that, or do you love Mondays? So this time of year has that sweet, awkward feeling about it. It's sweet, and I love the change of the colours and the feel, but it also brings with it that nervousness about starting new things. And I think this is because I like others here, all of us here, have gone through the system of having to be left at some point at the school gate and start all over again in a new place. And that brings with it, you know, that's not easy for any of us. And it's something wired into our deep, in our psychology. And I think whenever we get an echo of that at whatever stage of life we are, we feel the same sort of nervous feeling. Even Boris Johnson, believe it or not, feels this as he steps out sometimes. You know, the inside us, there's this anxiety thing that kicks in. And so it brings with it all sorts of feelings. And one of the things I want us to help over this new term, and me getting ready for this new term, is to work out patterns of living that will help us. And so the sacred rhythms idea is that we might end up being near Jesus. Is this me just fiddling with this? Is that? I try not to do that too much. Have I gone now? Is that better? Is that okay? Yeah, okay, good. What we're going to be looking at is solitude and community. Solitude and community. And shall I do this one? I feel more rock star when I'm doing this one, but I don't feel so comfortable. Well, actually, I'm more Britney when I've got this one, but yeah. And we're going to travel through these things. Now, the reason you might go through a kind of series of ideas, a kind of practices, spiritual practices, is that we might become the kind of people who point towards Jesus. So you can see what I've done with the stars there. Because that's what we want our lives to be like, aligned. And of course, our lives don't naturally align towards Jesus. They get knocked off beam. And so we need some ways of realigning ourselves. And so that, as I think about the new term ahead, I'm thinking, how can I align myself in the right kind of way to get myself where I want to go, which is to be a pointing towards Jesus person. And I wonder whether you feel ready for being that. And, you know, we've prayed for these young guys that they would be ready for this pointing towards Jesus thing that they do in their schools, which is probably the hardest place to point towards Jesus. Would you not agree? You know, we go to work, that's fine, isn't it? Everyone's polite and nice at work, or at least apathetic at the best, you know. But when you're at school, no, they rib you for anything, don't they? I mean, anything, you can get ribbed for anything at school, can't you? So, you know, if you say you're Jesus, you're a friend of Jesus, well, pointing towards Jesus is a really hard thing to do in all of our lives. And I think increasingly in all of our lives, this is going to be a hard thing for us as the church to be confident and comfortable with owning the name Jesus. A little while back, I found myself saying that I wondered if we were going through into a period of winter in terms of the way that we feel as Christians. That there's a period of where it's going to feel very cold and a bit gray, and we're going to, what do you do in winter? You huddle around a fire in order to keep yourself warm. And I wonder whether we're going to be tested for a while, because it's not going to be easy. And I think this is certainly true when you're at college or university or school. And I would encourage you to get around and huddle with your friends, because we need the warmth of that. And I wonder whether we're ready for the new term. I wonder whether we've got all the stuff in our bags. And I talk metaphorically here, you understand, because if we haven't got the, you know what it's like, have you ever been to the class when you haven't got the stuff in your bag? Well, it's not a good feeling, isn't it? And the teacher enjoys shaming you in front of everyone else. Obviously not every teacher, not the good ones like these ones over here. Yeah. Or maybe he's wondering about that. He's wondering about that, yeah. Here's a kid who's ready for school. I like this picture. He looks like he's ready for university in this picture. He's just like, I'm just going to Oxford. I'm just on my way. And sweet. And I wonder how we could be confident like that guy and ready for what lies ahead. I wonder what message Jesus might have for us as we enter a challenging context. Because as we walk into a group, as soon as we walk into a group outside of our own home, we walk outside of our own context, outside of the church, and then we walk into a group, we know that we're going to meet people of very different ideas and thoughts and beliefs. And we're going to have to work out how we communicate ourselves with them. We're going to have to work out what language we use and how we present ourselves. And we want them to like us, don't we? It's kind of like a deep need within ourselves to be liked. And we want to be appreciated and noticed. We have a deep need to be appreciated, and it's why if you have a sticker, and if you have a sticker book and you give out a sticker to someone, you just say, "Well done, thank you so much." Everyone else sits up. It's like, whatever they did, I want to do the same thing because I want a sticker too. Have you ever been like, Anyone? I've got a sticker. Would anyone like a sticker? Here you go. If I really did have a sticker, you really would want a sticker. There is something within us that makes us want to be noticed. And so we have to work out who we are in amongst the relationships across the group. And we notice that there's a hierarchy. Some people have all the stickers, don't they? Hate them. That wasn't a command. That was just a thought that crossed my mind. And some people have no stickers, and we pity them. Or they're worse than that. They don't even deserve any stickers. And we want to distance ourselves from them. And we have this natural way of creating hierarchies. And it's so wired into us. It's so wired into us that we'll do it almost instinctively. As you walk into a shop, if you walk into a supermarket, if you walk into a church, wherever you are, your judgment button will be pushed, and you'll work out who's who alongside them. You're wondering who's laughing, aren't you? Which hierarchy they fit on. I'm also wondering that as well. And so we have this deep need for belonging, which is a very powerful drive within us. And unfortunately, this doesn't end with school. We find ourselves that when we become adults, we just are just slightly older versions of what we were like when we were school, psychologically. And so we find ourselves on new days or returning from work feeling the same thing. And we stand awkwardly by photocopiers, hoping that someone will notice us. Or wondering about whether to speak out in a meeting when we feel like we've got something to say but unsure about it. Or feeling like we said something and then other people didn't respond very well, and then we go anxious about that and how did we do. And then we have these things called staff appraisals, which staff massacres, and we have these things and you worry about them for days. And then you're responsible for other people and you're wondering about how you're doing and your responsibility over them. And so we're constantly in this worry, in this place of anxiety. Does this resonate with any of you? Our position, our reputation, our standing, our sense of belonging is such a fundamental question for us all the time. And I think this story has something to offer us. I think this story has something to say to us. I don't know whether you remember what it was like, but I certainly do, of what it was like to feel the one on the edge of the group. My parents loved me so much, they sent me to a boarding school. Yeah, I'm working that out as well. And I'm very grateful for so many of the things. But one of the things you can't replace at a boarding school is home time and that feeling of being safe at last and going home. And there were many nights when I clung on to Jesus because I was worried about going back up to the dorm. I just didn't want to go there because the dorm wasn't safe. Or at least it didn't feel safe to me. Yeah, even as I speak it, I can feel the emotion in me because these are real things. And they lay layers of anxiety in our lives. And you find yourself feeling the same feeling, not quite even sure how to name it. And I wondered where I fitted in the hierarchy of popularity at school. I don't know if you had this. I was young for my year. I was a September kid, so I was ahead of myself, if you know what I mean. But that's no good thing, because it'd be better to be an old person in a year rather than a young person in a year. So my voice didn't drop as quickly as everyone else's did. So my nickname for the first year of secondary school was Squeak. Yeah, thanks for your sympathy. I appreciate that. Yeah. No, don't patronize me. Yeah. Yeah, and so you work through that, don't you? You have to work a way around this. And you try and go towards people and connect with them and find a way around you. I used humor. Humor was my way around in order to connect. I found a way around of finding a place of belonging in the hierarchy and competition of existence. That I used humor. And everyone else uses different things. Some use sport and others intelligence, others good looks. I tried that one, but that was beyond me. And No. Yeah. I just was trying to be humble then, that's all. And so, and I know what this picture is about from the inside, and maybe you do too, where you see a group of people and you're on the outside of this group of people. And you want to belong, but you know you're not cool enough, you're not intelligent enough, you're not sporty enough, you're not something enough, you're not good enough. So Jesus is invited to a prominent Pharisee's house on the Sabbath, his day of rest, and he's invited to this, and it's important that we notice the words, because the scripture uses words deliberately in such a way so that we pay attention to them. So prominent Pharisee, you know, that's the context of the story. So we can see the hierarchy there. Prominent Pharisee, top of the top, good of the good. And it's a big meal. He's invited to a feast, so he's wealthy and he's well-respected and everyone wants to be there and Jesus is invited. And you can tell in the story that this is there's lots of social positioning going on. And Jesus is being watched. You notice that in the story, that they were watching Jesus. And that's exactly what it's like to be a human being, isn't it? Everyone's watching you. And in fact, you're watching everyone else all the time as well. And so Jesus is very clear, or at least Luke notices it and writes it down. Jesus was watching them. And I don't know how that feels to you to be watched by Jesus, but it's a truth that Jesus is watching us all the time. And that could be a good thing to us. It certainly is at times to be know that Jesus is looking out for me. But other times I find his stare a little bit uncomfortable. And this is one of those uncomfortable stories where Jesus is watching. And I wonder what he was thinking. Well, it tells us what he was thinking. He could see them jostling for position because he could see that there was a place of authority and responsibility, and the cool guy was at the front and everyone wanted to be near him. And so when someone, he said this, he told them this parable. When someone invites you to a wedding feast, do not take a place of honor for a person more distinguished than you may have been invited. If so, the host who invited both of you will come and say, give this person your seat, and then you'll be humiliated. Have you ever had that feeling in school where you find yourself sitting on one seat and then, no, you can't sit on this table. That's the gooseberries. You have to sit on the blackberries. And you're thinking, oh, no, not the blackberries. Because even though they haven't called it a number, you know that blackberries is not as good as gooseberries. Teachers, they used names, but it doesn't work. We still understand what's going on. There's table one and there's table five, and we understand this hierarchy. And so you move to the good table and you get moved down to the lower table and you feel humiliated and everyone's looking at you. Go. Don't take the good seat. But when you're invited, take the lowest place. So that when your host comes, he will say to you, friend, move up to a better place. Then you will be honored in the presence of all the other guests. Because the other way around, can you imagine the feeling of going, no, you're not a blackberry, you're a gooseberry. I'm a gooseberry. That didn't sound so good when I said it then. But for all those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and all those who humble themselves will be exalted. So one of the things we need to notice when Jesus is saying this is that he's talking about himself. As well as even giving advice, as it were, he's talking about himself. He's not exalting himself, he's humbling himself. He's using his own example as an illustration of what it's like. And then what happens to Jesus? He humbles himself, and then what happens at the end? He gets exalted above all names. So Jesus tells us this, deliberately take the lowest place and avoid the place of honor. So my wisdom, my advice to all of us when we go back to work, when we go to a new place, when we go to college, whatever it is, find the blackberries. Find the lowest place you can go and see if you can hang out with some people at the low end of the table. When you're coming to church, do that. When you're, whatever situation Jesus is saying, when you enter new rooms, find the awkward ones around the edge of the room. Find the people who don't quite fit, stand by them. Position yourself, position your heart by the people who you feel maybe you're missing out on something. And you'll be blessed, he says. You'll be rewarded, rewarded now, but also rewarded in eternity. This will be to give yourself away. You may feel like you're going down the hierarchy somewhat, but do it deliberately. Deliberately choose to position yourself with the lowest. It's really interesting and very countercultural. What is our culture about, if not the opposite direction? Would you not agree? That everybody wants to position themselves with the coolest and with the best, which is exactly what we do all the time with our clothing, with our images, and with our houses. And which is, and have you ever noticed when you invite people around to your house that there's a bit before they come? When you act in a different way than you normally do, because you live in your house normally, and it's just normal, isn't it? And then the people are coming around, and what do? You tidy up, don't you? Yes. Because if they really knew what you were really like, they wouldn't like you. Or they wouldn't, or you think that, and so you position things in such a way as to make yourself more, well, you fit in the blank. So there's a bit of wisdom for us, and if when you go to your colleges and your universities and your class this term, if you deliberately go to the question is, how do we follow Jesus, isn't it? Well, this is what Jesus did. And so if you want to follow Jesus after Soul Survivor, then just find the low table. Or put a different way, find a position of humility. And I wonder whether St. Mary's could become this kind of church. So I've been thinking about putting a new website together. It takes a bit more longer time, or at least there are lots of other things to do, and I keep leaving it to the last thing to do. I haven't quite got round to it, but I've written a few things about values for St. Mary's that I would love us to hold, and one of them was humility. In fact, the first one was humility, and I wonder whether that's what other people would look at us and go, "Oh, St. Mary's, yeah, they're so humble." But wouldn't that be? I think that would look like Jesus if they. It would be good if we were humble, and I want to write a book on it one day. So that's a joke, by the way. So in contrast to humility, we have the culture that we live in. So we posture ourselves or present ourselves in a multitude of different ways, and we do that in order to get likes and to support our egos and our position. There's a guy called Irving Goffman, and I read this when I was at university in my first year of sociology, and the presentation of self in everyday life. He is a sociologist, the first sociologist, and it's not that long ago, so it just shows you how quickly we've come to see this as foundational. Now, this is everyday language. We all know that we present an image to everyone else. This is normal. And yet, before this book was written, nobody thought about us presenting like actors on a stage. Nobody thought that that's what we did. But it says here, "I shall consider the way in which the individual in ordinary work situations presents himself and his activities to others, the ways in which he guides and controls the impression they form of him, and the kinds of things he may and may not do while sustaining his performance before them." The book basically says that we're actors on a stage, that we present an image, we make up an image. And I would say that it's almost like a prophetic book. It's maybe about 50 years old, 60 years old. But the book is prophetic, and I think that's what we do now, constantly manufacturing self. They call it self-biography. Have you heard that phrase? That we're caught as a culture of self-biography where everybody has to narrate their own story of themselves and tell a little Instagram story every single day, a WhatsApp story. And we think that it's helping us. Here's another book. This is another sociologist called Marcel Mauss. I think that's how you say his name. Is that how you say his name? He's not a big guy. He's a... Forms and functions of exchange in archaic societies, called The Gift. And this book of sociology was really interesting because it peeled away. Again, it was one of the early books to try and work out, why do people give things to each other? What's really happening in a transaction of the gift? And giving is worth thinking about because we all do a lot of giving, and there are many different reasons for giving. And a lot of it, he discovered, was to do with our position, our reputation, our standing, our sense of belonging. that we give in order to produce, see ourselves in a better light. We feel good about giving to a charity and we feel better about ourselves. We give, we bring a bottle of wine round. Why do we do that? They have wine already. Why do we do that? Well, it equalizes the relationship, or it makes a connection. It says that we're not just recipients. We're not poor. We're equal to you. So we bring around a bottle of wine. It puts us on an equal footing. The hierarchy gets equalized. Do you understand? And so giving is, and even when you give a gift to your child or to a loved one, it's often about a relationship thing. There are all kinds of reasons that we might give things. And these are the ways that gifts work. Sometimes they're deserved or warranted gifts. So like you might have prize giving or sitting nicely on the carpet awards. Did your school have those? Mine did. I got a star in sitting nicely and on the carpet. And you got given a sticker or a reward of some kind. And that's often how gifts work, isn't it? That we look for people who deserve gifts. Now, they're still gifts. Someone might be incredibly wonderful and they get given a gift, a reward of some kind. The gift may still be a generous act, but it's something to do with their value. And the other thing is, it might be a useful gift. You know, I gave Angus a fantastic keyboard for his birthday. He's got a gift of playing the piano. So I gave him this amazing, or we gave him this amazing. Why did I give that? I wanted it to be useful for him. And that's a really good idea, isn't it? But I didn't give him a rubbish piano. I gave him the best one I could afford because I thought maybe he could use it really well and it would be useful for him. So I deliberately chose how to make this gift the most useful gift for him. So often we look at people and we think about whether we could give them a gift depending on how much use they might get from it. We don't give a set of golf clubs to someone who's lousy at sport. It's no use. So you give it to someone who's really good at sport instead. Do you understand? So we think about the usefulness of gifts. And then sometimes we give gifts in order to show off a bit. Extravagance, and we make a show of our gifts, and we love to be the first one at the bar buying a drink. And what does that do? It puts you in a position of authority or a status around everyone else. It's not a bad thing to do. I wish more people would do it. And it makes an impression. And then there are social glue gifts, and a lot of our gifts are social glue gifts. They're the ones that you give something and I give something. You give something and I give something. You give something and they just help us to keep going. This is what birthday presents are about, isn't it? Or Christmas presents is a better example. None of us need any of the stuff we have at Christmas. And we spend as much on each other, don't we? I spend 50 quid on Tori, maybe a little more, and then she spends 50 quid on me. And we could have spent our own money, but instead we gave a gift. Why do we give a gift? Well, it helps us remind each other that we love each other. It builds a relationship. It strengthens those relationships. They're social glue gifts. But there are unusual kinds of gifts. And stick with me, because Jesus is going to pop out the end of this. And that's wrong, isn't it, to say that? But there are gifts that come before the other person does anything. There's a preemptive gift, a thoughtful gift. I don't know if you've been around and a shop, and suddenly you see something, and regardless, you suddenly think, I've got to buy that for someone. And then you buy it for them, and then you give it to them, and they're blown away because there was no reason really to give it to them. It's a very powerful gift. It's an unusual gift. And then there's undeserved gifts, where the person isn't of value at all. In fact, they could be the lowest of the low, and you're going to give them the gift, and you know that they might even waste the gift. They might spend it in a bad way. But you decide to give it to them anyway, even though they don't deserve it. They haven't done anything for it, and they're never going to pay you back in any way, but you give it to them anyway. And then there's a development of that, which is unconditional gifts, where you expect nothing in return. You just want to empty your pocket. And these are more unusual gifts. And Jesus says, when you give a luncheon or a dinner, he's quite middle class in this story, isn't it? When you give a luncheon or a dinner, do not invite your friends, your brothers or sisters or relatives or your rich neighbors. If you do, they may invite you back and you'll be repaid. But when you give a banquet, Now, Jesus, when he uses phrases like banquet, we have to remember there's also a lot of imagery around wedding banquets, and us being caught up in a wedding banquet and us being invited into the wedding banquet. And we're the ones who are invited into his wedding banquet. When you give a banquet like I do to you, this is what I'm doing to you. When you give a banquet, invite the poor, the crippled, the lame, the blind, the broken, the uncomfortable, the socially awkward. Invite the undeserving. Invite those who don't get it right, who are unsporty, who are uncool, and you will be blessed. Although they cannot repay you, you will be repaid at the resurrection of the righteous. He's also talking about himself. He's encouraging himself in some way, but he's telling them, this is how you should live because this is how I live. This is how I am going to give away my life. I give away my life regardless of how worthy anyone is about in their lives. Regardless of how good they are, I will give myself to them. An undeserved gift. Before they even thought about me, I will give myself away to them. And so when we look at this story, we wonder what Jesus is saying to us, or at least I wonder what he's saying to us. And I think he's just re-inviting us into a new way of being alive, of being human. And I think this is very powerful for me. And I've tried to follow it in my life. And there'd be times I went to a boarding school, and so I learned halfway through that boarding school experience, I discovered that my experience was unlike the vast majority of people. And I had to work out what the vast majority of people lived like. And so I went on a summer event up a trip to a homeless shelter in Leeds, at St. George's, Leeds. Does anyone know that? And I spent my summer trying to work out how the poorest lived, and it changed my life. And I went on a summer camp, and like Soul Survivor, and this preacher man got up, and he started at the beginning of the Bible, and he went through it, and he literally had cut out of the Bible every single verse to do with the poor and the weak and the vulnerable and the widow and the orphan. He'd cut out every single verse of Scripture he discovered it was the second most important thing of the whole of Scripture, and he held out his Bible, and it was in tatters, and he says, this is what happens when you take out the poor and the broken and the oppressed from Scripture. You get a holy Bible. We laughed in the same way, as I recall. And he said that when you rip out these things, the whole story falls apart. So I was a middle-class kid, and I realized that I had to work out what it was to be in a different table to the one that I was given as my birthright, as it were. And that's a difficult journey, isn't it? And so I deliberately walked towards that, and that was a difficult and costly road, and we're still trying to work it out, Tori and I, what it is to position ourselves in humility with people who are not like us and speak differently and are awkward or broken in some way. So I met this girl, and some of you know this story already. I became a social worker and a family social worker, and I met this girl who was incredibly quiet. She couldn't speak. She was on the edge of the group. She came to this family center, which was run a bit like this center. And she came in, and I was in charge of the family center, and she didn't speak to me. I walked through the cafe area. She couldn't speak. She had two kids with her, and she came for the parenting evenings that parenting courses we were running, and the toddler groups we were running in the day. And she came along with her community care worker, and I discovered her name was Shamila, and Shamila came, and she was beautiful, but there was nothing behind her eyes. And she came week after week, brought by her community care worker. And then one day I came through the cafe, and I chatted to Shamila and said, "Hi, Shamila, how are you today?" And we had this conversation. It was a beautiful conversation, not in its complexity, but just because it was the first time she spoke to me in a kind of looking at me and conversing with me. And I found out a bit more about her kids. And then I felt really good after that conversation. I thought, this is what I live for. This is this transformation from seeing someone who's on the edge to becoming alive, a little bit more alive. And then the next day I was dropping Angus off at the school, the infant school around the corner, or going to a friend's house around the corner from the school. And I saw Shamila, maybe 5-6 o'clock in the evening, actually. And there was Shamila dressed up in leather, short skirt, on the corner, and I knew that this meant that she was working the streets, and I knew that therefore her kids were going to be at risk. You don't have to be a social worker to work that out. And so I became very anxious for the kids, and I became anxious for what her story was, and suddenly the whole of her story became more clear to me, and I thought, well, that's why she's maybe, there's nothing behind her eyes, because she's probably on drugs some of the time, and she's probably got an addiction, and she's probably been abused. And I narrated a story which just was self-evident, really, from that story, just about the kinds of things that she had experienced, and I made that up in my head, but probably half of it was true. And then I had to work out what I was going to do, and so I talked to the community care worker, and I told her that I'd seen Shamila on the street. And I never saw Shamila again, actually, because she never came back to the center that I worked. And it's always upset me, because I've never worked out what happened next. I've always lost her. But I went home that evening, and I said to Tori, I don't know that the church is, I don't know that we're doing the thing that we ought to be doing. How can we be a church where we could rescue Shamila? How could we be a church where we invite in people like Shamila? She needs counseling, she needs support, she needs money, she needs parenting, she needs grandparenting. She needs walking with, she needs caring for, she needs, her kids need support, she needs help with relationships, she needs wisdom, she needs everything. She needs a family to belong to. And I thought, who could do this? And I thought maybe the church could do it, but I knew that I couldn't do it. I didn't have the resources within me, and I felt empty, because I wanted to be this kind of church. And then it was really that seed of stuff thinking about, wouldn't it be good to be that kind of church, that led me to wanting to become a vicar. And I wonder whether we could be that kind of church, where we deliberately position ourselves with the poorest of the poor, and we would give ourselves away to those who are awkward and broken in some way. Deliberately honor people who can't pay you back, says Jesus. So Jesus, as I come to the end, would you help us to do this? Would you take your yellow sheet, your little yellow card? We're going to break bread as the final act together tonight. Thank you for listening so patiently with me tonight. Paul says, be devoted to one another in love. Honor one another above yourselves. He also says, do nothing out of selfish ambition, but rather in humility, value others above yourselves, not looking at your own interests, but to the interests of the others. In your relationships with one another, have the same mindset as Christ Jesus, who even though he had everything, gave up everything, so he became like a man. So as we start our new term, I wonder whether we could pray this prayer together. We'll read it through, and then you can take it home and pray it at home. Let's read it through together. I am no longer my own, but yours.
Covenant now made on earth, let it be ratified in heaven.